Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. You're listening at cindysheehansoapbox.com or communityprogressiveradio.org. Well, I'm going to tell you, not surprisingly so, that our show today is very special. We have two guests, a blog, Vast Left, and that's right, I said a blog, not a blogger, and courageous Palestinian rights activist and author of a new book called Freedom Sailors, Greta Berlin. So please stay tuned. We'll be back with Vast Left. Our first guest is Vast Left, a Boston-based blogger. Vast Left was a habitual Democrat, and he spent most of the 2000s looking forward to a meaningfully different replacement for George W. Bush, as we did. And he became very disappointed in Barack Obama. And we will see more of his bio, or the bio of the blog, and his cartoon called American Extremists in the interview. So let's welcome Vast Left to the show.
Vast Left, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Great to be here.
And as I told you before we started the interview, it's the first time I ever interviewed a blog, so this should be great.
I'm just like a one-man blog, what you see there is what you get.
But as you know, and as I've told you, I love your blog and I love your consistency, and at one point I even proposed marriage to you, but apparently as a blog you're already married.
Yep. The Vast Left blog is married, but very, very, very flattered. And Cindy, truly, you're a hero of mine. And so, it's always nice if anybody posts like an I love you comment or something like that when you post something that made them laugh or so on. But hearing a nice word from you just means that much more.
I just like your consistency and courage in the face of so much Obama apology going on out there that's kind of ridiculous. But so let's get into the actual interview then. Your blog name is Vast Left-Wing Conspiracy, and your cartoon name, American Extremists, sounds sort of radical, but that's not how you describe yourself, is it? Yet you've rejected the Republican-Democrat duopoly.
Yeah. It's funny. I haven't really been that conscious of it, but there are certain things that seem to happen kind of repeatedly with my blog. One thing is I started the blog on March the 1st, 2006, kind of after a lot of the wave of the bigger, more famous blogs started, but still with that theme of, how much more of this, George Bush presidency can we take? And so I was, yet another, liberal blog, and took my name from an extremely mainstream source. The blog, by the way, you can get to it, vastleft.com. It's on Google's Blogger, so it's vastleft.blogspot.com, but vastleft.com will get you there too. And just basically a play on the old Hillary Clinton, vast right-wing conspiracy thing. And mm-hmm. So really didn't come from any kind of hardcore radical lefty position, but simply, I was I don't know if I would say I'm exactly a garden variety Democrat, but I grew up thinking, positive things about, the various, Democratic, candidates and, those who got elected, those who didn't, and, voted reliably for Democrats for senator mm-hmm. and governor and so forth. Actually, the only time I voted, ever voted for Republican, I'm from Massachusetts, where I lived here most of my life, and I voted for Bill Weld, who was, clearly to the left of John Silver, who was, very, very close confidant of Ronald Reagan. So the only time I ever even thought about voting outside the Democratic fold was when the Democrat was clearly much tighter with the Republicans than the kind of old school Rockefeller Republican we had in Bill Weld. And so, I was, pretty, extremely reliable, defender of the Democratic Party. I mean, I would wring my hands over things like hawkishness that had been throughout the party, but by and large, I would defend the Democrats and would reliably vote for them. And so I started this blog in 2006 and basically focusing on the awful, many, many awful aspects of the Bush presidency and the religious right, which are obviously very tied in together. I don't want to get ahead of myself here too much, but talk about my evolution from a reliable Democratic voter to now a third party or none of the above type of voter. But the genesis of it was very mainstream Democrat. And as it happened, 4 years to the date, you know, not by design, but on March 1st of 2010, I got the hankering to start a little political webcomic. And since I really can't draw, I started with a very simple sort of two kind of oval-shaped, egg-shaped talking heads in two basic forms. One is a Republican talking to, you know, a less liberal, progressive, whatever you want to describe the guy. I tend to think of him as guy, you know, at least one of them has my voice, but I try to avoid getting too gender specific with them. Or, and that's when you see a red stripe on one side and blue on the other. The one on the right-hand side of the frame is actually the lefty. Poor planning on my part, I guess. And that person, you know, generally represents my point of view. When he's talking to the person in the red stripe.
That's my point of view, by the way.
Yeah, we could put Cindy under there too. It'd be fine by me. And so the one in the red stripe is, you know, is a Republican. But more often, it's the two of them in a blue square, and the one on the left side of the frame is, you know, I refer to that character as Proggy in my own head. I think maybe once out of over 400 cartoons, I think I've referred to that character by name. But basically, I've got sort of Righty and Proggy are the ones who are addressing me, who is Lefty. And and I decided to call the cartoon American Extremists, and really wasn't thinking about, boy, that might really sound very too edgy to some people. And it was just basically kind of a joke, because there is this running myth that's all throughout American politics at every level that we have these extremes in national politics, this extreme hard right and this extreme hard left. And I always ask people, for example, on the left side, certainly on the right wing side, you know, there's a pile of evidence mounting every day about the extreme right wing things that you pick your date you want to go to, whether it's Reagan or something before or something later, but where, you know, the norms in out of the White House and out of the Capitol are very, very far right. Who are these crazy lefties who are, you know, in national politics that are pushing this absurd left-wing agenda that no reasonable person would be, you know, unfrightened of? And they don't exist.
You coined the term two, the number two, the letter L, the number four, the letter O, 2L4O, meaning too left for Obama or too liberal for Obama, and you printed up T-shirts, and you sent me one that I have. So how much interest has there been in those shirts?
It's been pretty good. You know, obviously we're not sweeping the country, and I actually had a friend who does you know, press releases and things like that send out a bunch, and nobody from the press wanted to touch the story at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I thank you. And there were four featured stories. If you go to 2L40.com, that's another Blogspot site, so it'll redirect there, but 2L40.com. You can see see the shirts and see information about them, including a press release, which I really appreciate you, Cindy, and Bruce Dixon from Black Agenda Report, and Dr. Margaret Flowers, who is a wonderful advocate for Medicare for All, single-payer health care.
Right.
And Paul Street, who's written a guy very familiar with the Chicago political scene, who's written two books critical of Obama from the left, one before his election and one after a year or so of his being in the office. And so the four of them are all, I'm happy to say, 2L4O wearers and people who supported, getting our press release out and getting the word out about what a message was. And actually, the other day, and here's a celebrity who didn't bite, if you're listening, John Cusack, I'm talking about you. there was an interesting item you can find if you go to vastleft.com.
an interview, or kind of a chat that he had done with Jonathan Turley, you know, who writes about civil liberties issues.
Right.
And it was a very, Cindy, did you have a chance to see that chat between them?
I did, yes.
Yeah, and it was pretty interesting. And I really have to say, you know, with a lot of respect to John Cusack, because in the Hollywood scene, you've got the George Clooney's and just the list goes on and on and on of people who are politically active and politically interested, but will not cross the Democratic Party and will do anything but.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, even if the Democratic Party crosses them into policies that are really against their espoused values and interests. And so John Cusack, on the other hand, is very knowledgeable about, you know, particularly the civil liberties areas, the kind of things that, you know, people like Glenn Greenwald write about, and Jonathan Turley. And and they had this chat that was up on a blog. The name of the blog escapes me, but you can find the link from my site. And it was a really great chat, and they unearthed, you know, lots of the things that, you know, that people near their sphere, certainly John Cusack's sphere, would never dare to talk about. But what I did find is, and I've seen this also on his Twitter feed, that that John Cusack does stop short of saying, okay, for these reasons, I will not vote for Barack Obama. And he's given terrific arguments for why you wouldn't, and, you know, acknowledges it's a reasonable thing not to. And yet he says, for example, that Hillary Clinton's vote for the AUMF, the Authorization Use Force Against Iraq, was enough reason for him not to vote for her. I guess it wasn't enough reason probably not to vote for Biden or for Kerry or for Edwards. and the bill of particulars that he offers in terms of the drones, the privacy violations, and so forth, it's really, you know, quite a detailed argument, and yet he stops short of saying, I won't do it. And it would mean so much, and it certainly would have meant a lot during the primary process, and certainly would mean a lot to third-party candidates such as yourself. You know, they have, you know, this instance proof of somebody other than candidate Roseanne Barr, you know, in the Hollywood scene to say, you know what, this is a bridge too far. This is stuff I cannot abide. And he's
exactly,
really, really close.
Yeah.
So I wrote an open letter to him, offering him and Mr. Turley, Professor Turley, I'm not sure what his salutation is there, you know, one of these shirts as well, to, you know, if they could declare themselves, you know, out of the pool. And that's a term I like to use, which is the shallow end. And as I mentioned it to John Cusack in the open letter, it's not a flattering term. But but I think it's a really important thing to note that there is an awful lot of grumbling about Obama. You know, people who wring their hands over some of the things that they think that they certainly would have railed against if they were under Bush. But with Obama, they kind of, I'm not happy about that. And they might say, well, he has to, or he's doing the best he can, or he's naive. And they just can't bring themselves to say, no, this is a person like Bush, like Reagan, you know, some will say yes, some will say no, like Clinton. Someone who is opposed to the left liberal progressive agenda, someone who does things that are against the values and interests of really anyone who should, you know, who might consider themselves reasonably a lefty liberal progressive, whatever your preferred term of choice is. And so another term I've been pushing is the shallow end one, where, you know, if you're in the pool, you're in the pool. You know, you might wade into where it's very, very shallow, but getting out is a big step. And so I've seen a lot of people, some bloggers who, you know, Paul Krugman is one of these people too. I mean, you know, not so close to the election, you don't see a whole lot of questioning Obama in a serious way from him these days. But, you know, over recent years, he's given some very, very strong criticism of Obama. And then the next day, it'll come back to, oh, you know, he had to, he's doing the best he can, yada, yada, you know, and all the excuses. And that's what I refer to as the shallow end. You're still in that pool. When you get out, you're out. And when you get out, you're, among other things, legitimizing the idea of third-party voting, or, you know, some people, their agenda is not voting. That's not my agenda, but, you know, I respect people who feel that that's the right statement to make against a system that's gone pretty wrong or been pretty wrong for a long time. And
well,
so,
I can tell you, these people will get out of the pool if Romney is elected, and all of a sudden, all of this stuff that was okay during Obama's years are going to become bad again. So, You know, that would be one advantage of having a Romney presidency. People, you know, would be hypocritically critical again of the policies of the administration. We just have maybe like 10 minutes left, so I want to get to a couple more questions that I think are very important. It's you're in the progressive blogosphere. There's so many like fake progressive blogs out there that I just can't stand, like the Daily Kos or you know, Democratic Underground and places like that. But what's your experience in that blogosphere, being an Obama critic and an ex-Democrat, and now you're advocating for third-party voting?
It's been pretty bad, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of skip ahead to something we were talking about before we went on the air, this concept of tribalism, tribalism is a very, very powerful pull in politics. It's that sort of sense that belonging to something is more important, say, than the truth, or more important than policy, or more important than, fairness or kindness or anything else. It's just this pull of the tribe, this pull of the party, and we see it with religious extremism, and even sometimes not even with extremism, such as if you're in a small town where if you're not in the right parish, if you're, heaven forbid, an atheist or a Jew or a Muslim or something outside the norm there, in which you are just really treated as less than human, and for reasons that don't stand up in any way, shape, or form. And tribalism, even among people of the left who view themselves as humanistic and as logical and all these other things, and we saw this with the rise of Obama, which was a big part of what sort of pulled me from, my blinders as a Democrat, as somebody who would always sort of rationalize, whatever the party might have done. Obama came up at a time when the country was so reeling from right-wing politics. And everybody wanted like this idea of change. I mean, it was a great, brand to have, change after, after 8 years of Bush. People wanted that change. And so he came under the brand of change, but with the intention of doing anything but. And so as I heard his campaign rhetoric, which was always, described in these most glowing terms, it was so suffused with Reaganism. The market, the idea that we'll do these surges in Afghanistan, making the early moves of putting, so-called entitlements or security Medicare in the chopping block, a very corporatist approach to healthcare, so-called reform, and so forth. And the more I heard from Obama, the more I just couldn't believe that this was going to be our progressive savior. And not just like, well, here's the Democrat, probably better than McCain or whatever, but just the loftiest kind of claims to the man. And it just started, I started seeing all the things I used to just accuse the Republicans of, because it was very easy. I mean, you had to be delusional to praise the kind of presidency we got under Bush. And then I thought, oh my gosh, this happens on our side as well. And mm-hmm. So it's not like we have extremists on both sides. That, that's a very, very, very easy and very dangerous myth for us, that if only we could get to the center between these crazy extremists. Uh-uh, I'm not buying that. I haven't seen that at all. But what I have seen is the human foible of tribalism, the people that are on our team must be excused and praised and everything else, and the out-of-control rhetoric with Obama and the enormous need for something different from Bush at that time just made the scales come off my eyes. And it was like, oh, my gosh, my tribe is really just as crazy and delusional, and yet we're committing ourselves to is more of the same as what we're getting from the other party.
Well, we have the Ron Paul tribe, we have all kinds of tribes, and it's just like, I always tell people, hello, someone who has been in this and been criticized now by all sides, you all sound exactly alike, whether you're supporting Bush, whether you're supporting Obama, whether you're supporting Ron Paul, you all have the exact same rhetoric. You just changed the names of the people you're supporting.
Yeah. And as you pointed out, now you're mentioning in the shallow end context, I would say those people, of course, are still in the pool if a Romney comes in. They're in the Democratic pool. But yes, on the matter of issues, all of a sudden the policies that were A-OK or excusable or 11-dimensionally brilliant or whatever they are under Obama, all of a sudden every single thing that Romney does that's just like Obama, that's just like Bush, that's just like Reagan, just like Bill Clinton, and so forth, every one of these things, you know, when they happen from the other team, they're just the most horrible thing in the world. And come back to Glenn Greenwald, a point that he's made is that, you know, under Bush, you know, illegal wiretapping was just the most heinous sin. Writing out, you know, warrants just in thin air, saying this person will die, that person will die, including American citizens. Not that I think that's really such an important dividing point, but even that, no problem. We can accept that under Obama. Mm-hmm. And so all of a sudden, yes, you're absolutely right. You know, if Reagan comes in, and of course people like you and me who have advocated for voting outside the two-party box, you know, we'll be the first people the fingers pointed to, the kind of things that they ignore and justify and even praise under Obama, the second they'll happen to Romney, because they'll happen under him too, it'll be, see what you did to us. You know, right. You unleashed this monster.
Right, exactly. Yeah, speaking of Reagan, I was watching C-SPAN this weekend because I'm just a big nerd, and they had Reagan's nominating speech at one of the conventions, and lo and behold, he was talking so much about hope and change.
Mm. Yeah,
it's such a new thing. Obama's so original, isn't he?
Oh yeah, it's a very time-honored thing for, you know, sort of win friends and influence people or build cults or whatever you want to call it. Kind of thing, it's a promise and hope and change to, you know, particularly if people are not so happy with what their circumstances are. It's such a great catch-all because it, you know, doesn't really have to have any content. Cindy, actually, there's one topic I wanted to ask you about if we got time.
Okay.
And because it relates so much to tribalism, my own journey as somebody who, again, I don't consider myself some lefty radical, you know, which is fine, you know, for people who do have that vision. So, but me, I just, you know, they're just basic policies which seem very normal to want, and that you know, my habitual party has shown anything but interest in, but interest in the opposite. You know, your journey, of course, is something that's been famous, and you know, for someone like me, it's been very, very inspirational. But there's one thing I can't really understand, and I wonder what you make of it. It's, you know, what you went through with your son in the war, and your reaction is. Absolutely, how I would react if, you know, if my mm-hmm. child were put in a situation and killed in this wrong-headed war and so on, I can't imagine saying, well, it's all the best for God and country or something like that. I'd say, mm-hmm. why? You know, stop this. There has to be accountability. This is wrong. But why are you unusual with that response? Why do you think that isn't the way any mother reacts?
Well, you know, and that's a really good question, and that's something that I have been studying for like the last 8 years. Mm-hmm. But I wrote a book about it in 2009 called Myth America, the 20 Greatest Myths of the Robber Class and the Case for Revolution. And it's just basically that we are inundated and indoctrinated, of course, as good little patriotic Americans into these ideas that, you know, if the United States kills anybody, they deserve to be killed. They're our enemies. They're less than human. And I guess more refined thinkers would call it American exceptionalism. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I was called a traitor when I was in second grade, because when I was in second grade, the communism and the Cold War were like, it was in the heat of the Cold War. When I was in second grade, it wasn't that long after the Cuban Missile Crisis and things like that. And so my teacher asked us if a red communist, it was always a red communist back in those days, if a red communist came up to you and put a gun to your head and told you not to say the Pledge of Allegiance, what would you do? Well, you know, I raised my hand and I said I wouldn't say it. And so, but it seems pretty clear to me. So even back in second grade, I was
I was called a traitor and a bad American and sent to the corner because that was the wrong answer. And I was in the corner wondering why I would rather have my head blown off than not say the Pledge of Allegiance.
So
we have been indoctrinated that way. I ride my bike in this conservative town that I live in because I don't own a car, because I don't like to participate as much as I can't participate in the petroleum based economy. I try not to, and I see all these freedom isn't free kind of crap all over the place, and you know, it's just that indoctrination, and that's why people have such a visceral reaction to a Gold Star mother saying, oh no, wait a minute, it's wrong, it always has been wrong, it never will be right. You know, so it's this whole paradigm that we're trying to shift, and you know, it's not that easy, but we need millions of people pulling us back off the cliff, not just a few of us. And so I really appreciate that you're standing up to that paradigm too. So Vasilev, we are, I'm sorry I took so much of your interview time, but you asked. So tell my listeners what the address to your blog is again.
Yes, you can find us at vastleft.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at vastleft, and I'm on, you know, Facebook and Tumblr and all that stuff, so you can find it all links from vastleft.com.
And I will also link it in my newsletter that I send out. And again, thank you so much for your courage and your integrity and trying to move people to that left where we need to be, because I don't think it's an extreme position. I think it's a human position. Yesterday someone asked me why I was a socialist, and I said, because first I was a humanist. And I finally realized that socialist positions are the ones that help human beings. So thank you so much for helping us do that.
Well, Cindy, it's a pleasure and truly an honor to speak with you, and thanks so much for your kind words and support.
Okay. Keep up the good work, Vasilev, and we'll talk to you soon via the interwebs.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Our next guest is a very dear friend of mine, Greta Berlin. Greta's been my friend since before I went to Crawford in the summer of 2005, and she's still my friend. And she is a very courageous Palestinian rights activist, one of the founders of the Free Gaza Movement, and now co-author of a book called Freedom Sailor about the freedom flotillas to Gaza. Let's welcome Greta to the show.
Greta Berlin, welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Well, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, I am delighted to have you and to speak with you again. And full disclosure to my listeners, I'm not impartial. I love you and I love your work, and you're a good friend of mine.
And the feeling is mutual. So I guess I'm not very impartial either.
So let's, before we talk about your new book, Freedom Sailors, tell my listeners a little bit about yourself and really what led you to writing this book.
I'm one of the original co-founders of something called the Free Gaza Movement. And we were the movement that started to send boats to Gaza. We started the movement back in 2006, and then we sent the very first boat in August of 2008. And, of course, that's what the book is all about. But if people know us at all, it's probably they know us because of the flotilla and when the Israelis murdered 9 of our passengers on board that flotilla. So I've been involved with that now for 6 years, but I've really been involved with the Palestinian cause almost all my life, ever since I was in my mid-20s.
And why is that?
I married a Palestinian. Like many people who get involved with the Palestinian cause, it's because we met a Palestinian somewhere along the way. They were roommates or they were friends. In my case, it was my husband. And he was a 1948 refugee, and I have 2 children, and my 2 children cannot go home to the place where he was born and raised. He was born and raised in Safed, Palestine. And they're not allowed there. They're not allowed there because they're Palestinian. And so originally I got involved because I was so outraged that my children were denied half of their heritage. They have grown, they've gone, they have their lives, they're proud of me, but I have stayed with Palestine because 47 years later, it still has not been resolved.
Right. And so what about the Gaza situation that has brought that to the focus of your activism?
I think what happened to many of us is when Israel invaded Lebanon back in 2006, and the world was paying attention to the fact that they were busy murdering the people in Lebanon, nobody paid any attention to the Palestinians of Gaza. And so a lot of us became very concerned that what they were going to do is to continue what I call their slow-motion genocide against the people of Gaza. And that's why many of us got together and said, we need to bring to the attention to the world what is happening in Gaza. People call it an outdoor prison. I call it a concentration camp. You cannot get in. You cannot leave. At least in prison, you do have some kind of rights. And so we felt that the only way that the world was going to pay attention to the 1.5 million people who live there is if civil society did something about it, because governments are not going to, and they still aren't. We're talking about 6 years later now, and governments have not done anything to alleviate the suffering of the people of Gaza.
What is the situation today? How is the Egyptian crossing from Egypt to Gaza going, and what is the status of that?
You know, it's certainly better. Mubarak was just a dreadful man, and he simply closed the gates of Rafah, and he also locked the key from his side as well. So this new regime in Egypt is definitely better because they're part of the same Muslim Brotherhood. But I think the point that people have to realize is that Gaza is the only territory on the Mediterranean, the only territory on the Mediterranean that does not have access to its own sea. The fishermen can only fish about 3 miles out of the shores of Gaza. And even if the Egyptians open the Rafah border, that doesn't help the fact that the Gazans need their own ability to leave and to come back and to fish and to trade. What we have always said is we are not in the business of delivering humanitarian supplies. We are in the business of making sure the world understands what Israel has done to the Palestinians. And they're much more interested in trade and not aid. They're perfectly capable of taking care of themselves.
Right. What is Israel's justification for walling off Gaza?
Well, their justification, like all thugs, is that it's all about the security of the Israelis. But the real justification, and it's in the book, is that they're busy stealing the gas that belongs to Gaza. We call it stealing Gaza's gas. In 1999, British gas found about 4.3 trillion cubic feet of gas, natural gas, mm-hmm. under the shores of Gaza. And so Israel has a rig up. Granted, it's on the Israeli side, but we are pretty sure that they're probably slant drilling into that field to suck as much out as they can, because it has always, for Israel, has always been about stealing the natural resources of the Palestinians. It has never been anything to do with security, except that is their good excuse. They do the same thing the Americans do. Why did we go into Iraq? Well, we wanted to make Iraq secure for its people and bring democracy to the people. No, we didn't. We wanted to steal their natural resources.
Right. You know what? That's interesting, because I follow world geopolitics and things like this very closely, and this is the first thing I've ever heard of Gaza sitting on a large reserve of natural gas.
There's enough natural gas under the shores of Gaza to turn Gaza into a mini Singapore. That's how much gas they have. And if you Google stealing Gaza's gas, you will find now more and more articles written about the fact that this is what Israel is doing. And by the way, Israel is stealing it under the auspices of Tony Blair for a while, and I think he's still working on it, and also the Palestinian Authority. When Israel managed to separate the occupied West Bank from Gaza, you've got the Palestinian Authority, that Quisling Abbas in power there, and then you have Hamas. So they have managed to put a wedge in between the two sets of Palestinians, because it's not, it really belongs to the people of Gaza. And
right.
unless the people of Gaza and the people of the West Bank can get together as a territory or a country, then the Palestinians on the West Bank are going to see that the natural gas is going to the people of Gaza. Well, actually, it's not going to the people, it's not going to the Palestinians at all right now. It's really being sucked out of the Gulf by the Israelis and by an agreement with British Gas. So it's been a very interesting, I spent 35 years working for the oil business. That's
mm-hmm.
what I did before I retired. So I really knew about this long before anybody else did, because they were one of my clients. BG was one of my clients. And they were very upfront. They said, if this gets, if the gas fields go into effect and are able to be pull out the natural gas, Gaza is going to be a mini Singapore. And Israel is not about to let that ever happen.
Right. Well, also, Israel gives, like, the public appearance of paranoia, of wanting to keep themselves safe in the region. But, of course, Israel, probably more than any other country in that region, has the ability to defend itself, mostly due to the over $3 billion a year the U.S. gives them. But what do you think that that's kind of the same? And this is probably just a rhetorical question, but do you think that's the same kind of energy behind the we have to attack Iran before they get a nuclear weapon kind of thing?
Sure it is. It's, I mean, Israel has managed to turn itself into a ghetto. It's tragic for its people that it has done that, and they have a ghetto mentality, and they look around and they look for enemies. And so if you don't have Iraq as an enemy, or you don't have Lebanon or Syria or the Palestinians, then you definitely you must have Iran as your enemy. So it's that kind of ghetto mentality that perceives the world as your larger enemy. And it's not good for the region. I mean, what Israel needs to do is to grow up. It needs to grow up, and it needs to share. And it needs to do what my mother used to say, and that is share all your toys in the sandbox. Everybody will like you a lot better if you share your toys. And Israel does not want to do that. So it's busy stealing the water from the Palestinians in the West Bank. It's busy stealing the natural gas from the people in Gaza. And it's busy doing as much as it can to make sure that the United States goes to war with Iran. And that's what they're doing exactly right now. That's what they're threatening. We are going to strike Iran before the elections.
Right.
So they're like this mad dog that somebody has let off the leash. And it's from my own personal point of view, I'm more worried in the last, I'd say, a couple of months than I have ever been
mm-hmm.
about what will happen in the Middle East.
Yeah, it looks really precarious about Iran right now. And I know that we've been in the movement, have been talking about this potential for invading Iran since 2005. And it looks like it's getting, like, scarier and scarier by the minute.
Yeah, I think that it is. And it's not, again, it doesn't have anything to do with the fact that Iran may be capable of making a nuclear weapon. Israel already has 200 nuclear weapons. It's because Israel doesn't want to have any competition. Israel's very good at blackmailing the rest of the world and pretty much saying, if you don't do it our way, we're going to threaten you with our nuclear weapons. Well, you can't do that if you've got somebody in your region that has one as well. If you look at Pakistan and India, they both have nuclear weapons. As a result, they've both been pretty quiet
mm-hmm.
because it evened it out. And that's it. Either you take all of the weapons away or you give
right.
all the weapons to everybody.
That's right. I agree. I prefer to take all the weapons away from everybody. But, you know,
we would like them all to go away forever and just stop playing with dangerous toys that can blow up the world. But if you're going to do that and you're insisting that you get to keep yours, then everybody should have one.
And that's one thing about imperialists. They have not 1 ounce of respect for any country's sovereignty.
Well, and all you have to do if you want to look at Israel, Iran hasn't attacked anybody in 200 years. Israel has attacked every one of its neighbors many times.
Mm-hmm.
And so you think, well, wait a minute. If you follow this carefully, as you said both of us have done, why are they talking about Iran being dangerous when, in fact, it's Israel that's being dangerous, just like it is the United States that has been dangerous in Iraq? I mean, this is not, it just does not take much analysis to realize what's going on. But it, unfortunately, Americans watch too much Fox TV.
Right, or MSNBC or CNN. It's all the same, same propaganda, just marketed a little bit differently, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think that one of the reasons that the voyages that we did into Gaza were so successful, and they were tremendously successful, is because civil society realized that it could do something. And I have a friend of mine who works in the Tunisian Revolution Council, and he was actually on the very first voyage with Free Gaza. And he said to me a couple weeks ago, you have to realize that Free Gaza gave hope to the people of the Middle East. He said, you were one of many sparks, but people began to look around and say, gee, if 44 people can get on two rickety old boats and sail across the Mediterranean to Gaza, just think what civil society is capable of doing. And he said, you gave us hope. That's what you did. You gave us hope. And if I had any legacy, I would hope that that's what it was, that people began to realize that civil society, from Occupy Wall Street to the boats in Gaza, that we can make a huge difference.
Well, talk about your new book, Freedom Sailor. This is a perfect segue into that.
It took us as long to write the book as it did to get the boats into Gaza the first time. It took us 2 years to get the boats into Gaza from 2006 to 2008. And Bill and I, he's the co-editor, he and I started writing this book in 2010, shortly after the Israelis had murdered all the people on board the Mavi Marmara. Because what the media was doing is that the media was saying that this was a bunch of crazy lunatic Turks, and they were shouting and yelling all kinds of things. None of that, of course, is true. And that somehow this was the very first voyage to Gaza, when, in fact, Free Gaza had been going for 2 years, and successfully going. We got in successfully for 5 times. So we started collecting people's remembrances of that voyage, and we started trying to find a wide variety. We have a Greek journalist who writes. We have people from Gaza. We have two Australians. We have 3 or 4 Americans. And we started collecting their remembrances of that first voyage. The book started out as about 500 pages, and it is now at 250. So just to be able to pick out the things that were really important and that were also interesting for people to read, and to get it into a book format where when you pick the book up, you are not going to want to put it down, because you're going to want to turn the page and find out, how did that man commit suicide? What did the U.S. government do to him? What happened with the mutiny on board one of the boats? You're not going to want to put the book down. And so what we were hoping is that we would have a historical document. This is how Free Gaza started. This is how the voyages started. But we also wanted to entertain.
Mm-hmm.
We want people to laugh, because some of it's funny.
Exactly. So, Greta, of course, I think that what you all did and what you're doing is incredibly brave. It's like on the, on the level of Rachel Corrie and what she did to try to help the Palestinian people. Have you been following the Corrie's case?
They're supposed to have the verdict tomorrow. And I would bet you that the vast majority of us who were on those boats in 2008 had gotten actively involved in the international solidarity movement because of Rachel Corrie. Even if we didn't know each other, and most of us didn't, we had one common memory, and that was that we had all been part of the International Solidarity Movement. And most of us had done that because Rachel Corrie had been murdered. So again, this is this kind of cycle that continues, that nobody realized that because Rachel Corrie was murdered, that many of us would go to the West Bank, that we would continue to stay in touch with each other, that we would then start the Free Gaza movement, that we would send the voyages. These are the good circles that people need to try to continue.
What I think that I want you to talk about the official U.S. response to the Freedom Flotillas, but have you received any support from any world governments a basic resolution in support of the Freedom Flotillas?
I would say that if anybody had an official document, it would be Ireland. You know, mm-hmm. The Irish understand what it's like to be occupied.
Yeah.
So the Irish have been by far our biggest fans. We've had members of Parliament from Ireland on board our boats. We've had, I think Scotland has done the same thing. Malaysia has also had a document in support of the flotillas. But if you're looking at the big movers and shakers like France and the United States and the UK, the answer is no. The United States is doing its very best to either ignore us or to demonize us. And in fact, one of the passengers who was murdered on the Mavi Marmara is an American. He was born in the United States, and he had American citizenship. His name is Furkan Doğan, and he was the youngest one who was murdered. And to this day, the United States State Department has not put him on the list of murdered Americans.
I think not just demonize you, but almost criminalize what you were doing.
They have managed to make sure that they'll do their best to marginalize us, or they call us names, we're the crazy hippies. I mean, you know what that's like. You know how easy it is for them to try to pick you apart. You've got to have a really tough skin, because if you don't, you can really get discouraged. I've just never been discouraged. Neither have you. I mean, that's
right. One
of the things that happens. If somebody said to me, "Why do you continue this?" and I said, "Well, if you want to find an adjective that describes me, it's determined, and I'm not going to stop." So I think that what happens to the United States government in particular is that they have tried very hard to marginalize us. But you have people like Colonel Ann Wright, who was on the boat. You've got people like Alice Walker, who was on the last flotilla. People like Ray McGovern. You know, it's awfully hard to demonize those kinds of people. So I would say that in the last year or so, the United States government is just ignoring us, which is fine.
Better than the alternative. So do you have any other flotillas planned for the future?
Well, we have two things actually going right now. I don't think Free Gaza will probably ever send boats again. We've gone on, many of us, to do different things. Writing the book. People have been involved in the Tunisian Revolution, for example. But we are still part of the movement, and we still have people that we work with. There is a Swedish boat right now called the Swedish Boat to Gaza. It's on its way right now. It's called the Estelle. And it left Sweden about a month and a half ago, and I think it's on its way to Spain right now. It's an enormous, beautiful sailing boat. It picks up people along the way, and it's gotten an awful lot of coverage here in Europe. What we thought after they stopped the flotilla last year and then they murdered the ones the year before is that we would tell people, go when you're ready. If you have a boat and you're ready to go, and you have it all organized, just go. Don't wait.
Yeah.
And that's exactly... So instead of going in 6 and 8 boat convoys, we're going in waves. So that one is on its way already. We're also working on another initiative called Gaza's Ark, and that's going to go in the spring of 2013. And that is a boat that's being built in Gaza. so we will end up giving people jobs in Gaza. They're going to fill it with products in Gaza, and they're going to sail it out of Gaza and into Europe. You know, it's much more exciting because it's not just about our going in. It's about the right for them to come out. So those are the two projects I'm working on. And, in fact, the book, the royalties from the book, Bill and I do not keep. Everything that the all the money we make on the book will go to Gaza's Ark. And then go to the people of Gaza.
And Greta, and, you know, I know why you keep going. You keep going because Palestinians are still being oppressed. And I keep going. People always say, Cindy, how come you haven't quit yet? You got your 15 minutes. The wars, and guess what? The wars are still going, so I'm not going away.
Exactly. And it has nothing to do with 15 seconds of fame. It has nothing to do with any of that. I will quit the day that the people of Palestine are free.
Absolutely. Same here. Or until we can't physically go ahead.
Exactly. Yeah. That may come sooner than the people of Palestine being free, but I'm still optimistic that that's going to happen, certainly in my life and definitely in yours. So,
well, you're setting up the I can get more information about the book and about the movement.
It's very easy. Just go to freedomsailors.com. And you can buy the book. You can buy it through PayPal or through CreateSpace. You can buy it through Amazon. You can get a Kindle. It's got color photos in it. It's got black and white photos in the book. You can ask me. I'm out in the Bay Area, I think, in October, the end of September, beginning of October, to do quite a few venues talking about the book. So if you want a signed copy, I'll let you know, Cindy, when I'm there. So. Mm-hmm. You can let everybody know, but it's very easy to get the book. It's not the book is only $15 plus postage, or $9.99 for the Kindle book. You get a great read. You help the people of Gaza. How can you possibly go wrong?
On your website too?
It's on the freegaza.org website as well.
And if I see you, and buy a copy so you can sign it for me.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to that, and I'll see you in a couple weeks.
Greta Berlin, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
You're welcome. Looking forward to seeing you.
Me too.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Well, that's our wonderful show for the day. I told you it was going to be a super-duper show, and I hope you did learn something, and I hope you were inspired, and I hope you were inspired to look more into these issues or to become more active in your sphere of influence or someplace you want to be your sphere of influence. As always, I'd like to thank Don DeBar, my engineer, and the contact with Community Progressive Radio. I'd like to thank Mikey, my producer. I'd like to thank Greta Berlin and Vast Left for being on the show today. And as always, my highest thanks and gratitude goes to you, the listeners. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Peace out for now.
Jingle, jingle, little star, how I wonder what you are.